We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
This morning's reading comes from the book of Ecclesiastes, the Hebrew Bible. Illusions of illusions, says the teacher. Illusions of illusions. All is illusion. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on the circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. This also is illusion and a chasing after breath. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time for giving birth and a time for dying. A time for planting and a time for harvesting what is planted. A time for killing and a time for healing. A time for destroying and a time for creating. A time for weeping and a time for laughing. A time for mourning and a time for dancing. A time for throwing away stones and a time for gathering stones together. A time for embracing and a time for refraining from embracing. A time for seeking and a time for losing. A time for keeping and a time for throwing away. A time for tearing and a time for sowing. A time for keeping silence and a time for speaking. A time for loving and a time for hating. A time for making war and a time for making peace.
We come here today humbled by the uncertainty of our times. We return here today to a touchstone of our lives. We arrive here today audacious enough to hope that by our participation in these moments, our fears of uncertainty might be transformed into a celebration of uncertainty. We come here to connect with our most profound understandings and to give our most generous attention to our ideals, our truth, and each other. We are here, humble and hopeful. And so we give thanks for this company, for this time, and for this place, and ask that it train and sustain us for mercy and grace. Amen. Today is a good day. These are uncertain times, but this hour is a good hour. This breath is good breath. And they are good precisely because we are here to recognize them as good, to praise them and be grateful. And the way you're sitting and thinking is also good, as are these words, good words, framed as we all are by this day and this hour. But in the midst of this goodness, there is anxiety. And in the midst of our gratitude, there is resentment. In the midst of our praise, there is judgment. We are conflicted as bodies and as a body. And this is really no surprise. We're complex. We're messy. On a metaphysical level, we're somehow complete and incomplete at the same time. That there is anxiety and judgment and resentment need not mar the goodness of this hour, and may in fact highlight it. After all, there are reasons why we are here this morning, admirable reasons. There are causes that account for our choosing to show up in this place. We want to be here, so give thanks for that. Despite our troubled hearts, and maybe because of them, we each made a conscious decision to come worship together. Or did we? Was it really ever a choice? Were we going to come here, regardless of our experience of deciding to do so? Perhaps it was preordained, written in the stars or in the book of life. Could it be that your being here today was a predestined result due to nigh on infinite causes and consequences dating back to the Big Bang? A series of causes and consequences that you have no say in whatsoever. I know that's not what it feels like. It feels like you choose to be here this morning, but the paradigm in which we live maintains that while there are forks in the path, there was never really any question about which path is taken. Choice is a figment, free will, an illusion. So here's a story. And tell me if you've heard this one before. A man came face to face with the truth in the form of an apple. A curious fellow, he was fascinated by the natural scene around him and the apple tree near which he sat. And then came the fall, and everything changed. To be clear, it was the apple that fell and not the man. You see, our protagonist's name was Isaac Newton, and that changed everything. What was changed was his assertion that an unseen but distinct, measurable, and predictable force was causing the apple to fall to the ground. No longer did God keep the seas at bay. No longer did reality have a purpose. Be careful of apples, people. They keep the doctor away, sure, but as Adam before him and then Isaac Newton can attest, they have a conspicuous and dramatic potential to destroy worldviews and realign identity. For no less than that is what gravity did. The discovery of gravity was an assault. The final and definitive assault on the preceding paradigm. And like most assaults, this one had collateral damage. Much like Galileo and Darwin, Newton did not set out to kill God. And yet, there lies the Occidental deity amongst the rubble of antiquity. And next to him lay the corpse of free will. It might come as a shock that God and free will were in a relationship of such intimacy that they would both be felled by the same apple. It's certainly not without irony. To many here, an omnipotent, omniscient God might be synonymous with predestination and the suppression of free will. And yet, in the end, the paradigm that Newton and his kind ushered in eliminated the possibility of either. Here's the forensics. The way Newton described gravity set us on a trajectory of cause and effect where every event has material causes, identifiable, measurable causes. And every effect can be predicted by taking these causes into account. This view is maintained in physics, biology, neuroscience, psychology. It is a notion of reality where our predictive accuracy is limited only by the amount and accuracy of the information we possess. The metaphor is billiard balls. The metaphor is a machine. And it is a powerful worldview. Cause and effect took humanity to the moon. However, our personalities, our decision-making methods are reduced or perhaps elevated to a definite, if difficult to figure, mixture of DNA, biological secretions, and socialization that is purely mechanistic. This knowledge is inherent, however threatening it sounds. After all, we debate about whether a cause was nature versus nurture, not whether there was a cause. If you play that out, folks, it leaves no room for free will. But let me shift the perspective a little bit. I first started thinking about this when I was considering the Buddhist concept of Pratityasamutpada, or something close to that. This is the doctrine of dependent origination, mutual causation. Essentially, this observes that every being is contingent on every other being, that reality arises in an infinite and interdependent web of causation, that nothing in the universe exists without everything else in the universe. That made sense to me. I could kind of reverse engineer my present to that conclusion slash origin. So I was thinking, if everything causes everything, that doesn't leave much room for free will. But I've grown up to really value free will. So this was a riddle. And then it occurred to me, hey, this interdependent web thing sounds kind of familiar. It's right there in our UU principles. And now, to be fair, the committees at General Assembly didn't come up with the interdependent web out of thin air. It is attested to in several ontologies from Buddhism, the environmental movement, and deep ecology, physics, Western philosophy. It's the butterfly effect, where the flapping of a butterfly's wings in Botswana has some consequence eventually in Siberia. But think 1,000 butterflies, 1,000,000 butterflies. Think every butterfly that ever lived. Let's just imagine this for a moment. Think of a spider web. You're a node, maybe a strand between two nodes on the web. And I'm assuming that a spider web, as we imagine it, is one-dimensional, but existence is not. So at every node, imagine several other strands connecting at every conceivable angle. Each of these strands connects to a node in yet another web. And each node in another web has strands attached to it at every conceivable angle to yet other webs. And this tightly compacted weave of interconnectedness is as big as existence, which is this big. If I move one node here, everything moves. Every event is a cause. And if it's all cause and effect, then what a free will. Under pressure from all of existence, is there any room for it? So Newton and gravity and the billiard balls, cause and effect, present a significant challenge to free will. Buddhism and our own UU principles severely limit any notion a free agency. And it's beginning to feel a lot like piling on, but contemporary science kicks it to the curb. Benjamin Libet conducted the touchstone experiment for this in the 1970s. He was able to determine that people were acting before they decided to act, even though they thought they were deciding to act before they acted. He found that the brain had initiated movement before any conscious decision to move had been made. According to Libet, free will, insofar as it is consciousness, is more like storytelling than decision-making. It is purely after the act. In a more recent study, Yale psychology professor John Barge sent one of his grad students into town, arms full of papers and a briefcase and pens and all sorts of stuff and a cup of coffee. The grad assistant would then administer a survey to random passers-by. And the survey described a person named Joe, included his photograph, and asked basically, "Do you like Joe?" And sometime near the beginning of this encounter, the grad assistant would ask the surveyee to hold his coffee cup for just a moment as he readjusted the stuff that he was holding and then take it back. And it was very casually done and very briefly done. The trick is that some people were given hot coffee and some people were given iced coffee. Consistently, the clear majority of the people who held the hot coffee liked Joe. And the clear majority of the people who were given iced coffee did not like Joe. You think the cold coffee people think they made a decision of their own free will to not like Joe? In a recent interview, Malcolm Gladwell, author of best-selling novel or books Blink and The Tipping Point, drives home the argument. Specifically naming the research of one Daniel Wegner at Harvard, Gladwell states, and this is a quote, "If you go through all of this research that's been done in psychology recently, you end up with the position that the conscious will is an illusion." And we could even do a little experiment here this morning. And it goes as follows. So decide you are going to close your eyes. Relax. Pay attention only to your breathing and sort of meditate. Have no thoughts. So you get it. If you were in charge, it would be no problem to stop your thoughts. And it would be very surprising if most of you didn't find it exceptionally difficult to do that. The brain is generating them in spite of your conscious best intentions. And that's what it's designed to do, regardless of whether you want it to or not. It has been said that we are each of us 100 trillion cellular robots who are not self-conscious and who do not know who you are. So by now, I'm hoping that I've put some serious questions into your brain about the possibility of free will, as if you could choose to believe it or not. This might be the grown-up version of being told there's no such thing as Santa Claus. It's a bummer. I mean, is it so much to ask? I'm not asking to control the stars or even a starship. Not even asking to control someone else. I just want the dignity of self-control. And so now, inherent dignity is collateral damage, too. And what does it say about morality? Did we just obliterate the notion of beneficence? Did the distinction between good and bad just evaporate? We're all part of a unplanned plan with no triumph of progress or humanly understandable goal of any kind, is there any meaning to be had at all? These are serious questions. For what it's worth, they are being hashed out by our champions of philosophy and science even now. In fact, if you want, you could watch parts of the conversation on YouTube. I've watched far too much of these the last few weeks, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to disregard them. Because sometimes you can't fix a problem from the same vantage point and with the same tools with which you created it. It's harder to find your way out of a maze when you are in it than when you are above it. So we need to shift our perspective. It's like a couple of Sundays ago, Edward, my erstwhile coffee assistant, and I were trying to teach Spencer some really big words. For those of you who don't know, Spencer is our director of religious education's little boy. He's about 4 or 8 or some small number of years old. And he's the one in the kids' choir that usually looks like he's about to jump out of his socks. He's a great kid. And so we were trying to teach him the word synesthesia. We wanted him to blow his teacher's mind on Monday. And we weren't really successful. But I did ask Spencer, what was the biggest word he knew? And he thought for a bit and then replied, the sky. The sky. Right. So thank you, Spencer, for teaching me a truly big word. And now we have a shift in perspective. Let's have a fresh look at how this argy-bargy began. Go back to the interconnected web of existence and understand this. Every event in the world that has happened, every breath, every confession, every joy, every misspelling, every shift of sand on the ocean's floor, every leaf dying in autumn, every inching of every worm, every event is plugged into you. It's shaping and propelling you. Can you feel it? Well, can you feel some of it? Maybe. Can you imagine it? I think so. In some way, yes. And that is the trick. The quantum physicist John Wheeler puts it this way. There is no there out there. All we know is how we correlate with the world. We do not really know what the world is really like without us. When we seem to experience an external world that is out there, independent of us, we're really just dreaming it up. Modern neurobiology has reached the exact same conclusion as quantum physics. The visual world, what we see, is an illusion. The science writer Tor Nordtranders, author of The Generous Man, writes that the merging of the lesson from quantum mechanics with the lesson from neurobiology attests to a very simple fact. What we perceive as being outside of us is indeed a fancy and elegant projection of what we have inside. We do make this projection as a result of interacting with something not inside, but everything we experience is inside. So there are causes, but we are imagining our experiences of them. In some way, we're projecting the events that determine our actions. And that's not necessarily free will, but it is a radical kind of agency. I don't even think we have a word for it. I mean, the sky, you know, the sky inside. This is a radical agency. This is the agency with which we can reappropriate our inherent dignity. So the next time you go outside and look up, I want you to see that great big word, dignity. On top of all that, this radical agency is correlated. It's all interrelated. It's entirely relational and co-arising. It is pratityasamutpada, which, by the way, is a seriously big word. So if this is the adult version of the unmasking of Santa Claus, we can, as we did as children, take solace in the fact that we still get presents. It's not Santa. It's better. It's our parents. It's our relationships. Yeah, we still get presents. We get life. We get love, hope, fear, breath, fresh bread. Now I can say, without exactly lying and for similar reasons, that yes, Virginia, there is a free will. So today is a good day. And this breath is good breath. And they are good precisely because we recognize them as good. We praise them and are grateful. And the way you're sitting and thinking are good, correlated, as we all are, with this day and this moment. Free will, experientially and existentially, is akin to emotion. To deny it would be like denying the reality of love or hate or hope. And as it turns out, emotions are among the primary building blocks of our reality. They have kept us alive and evolving since they emerged in our being. They are the connective tissue in our sense of reality. They are the connective tissue between each other. This is radical agency, but it's also relational agency. We need the world, and we need each other. So look around. When you see your neighbor's faults, then you will see your own also. When you see your neighbor's dignity, then you will have secured your own. Let us embody that with ritual. Again, I'm going to ask you guys to find yourself next to somebody. So if you're sitting alone, or if you see somebody sitting alone who is not as mobile, if you could orient yourself so that you're next to them. So for now, if you would, hold out both of your hands, palm up, gesture of openness, of asking and receiving. And if the next gesture makes you uncomfortable, it's okay. Honest religion also sometimes takes us out of our comfort zone, but it's a good thing. So keep your left hand open, but with your right hand, place two or more fingers on the wrists of the neighbor to your right. Over here, on the side, a little under the thumb. If you're unable to find a pulse, it's enough to know that it's there. If you are on an aisle or sitting by yourself, one thing you could do would be to hold your hand open and just feel the qualities of the air, the temperature, the movement. And you may choose now to close your eyes or not, however you're comfortable. And breathe in. And exhale slowly, as if you were meditating. And keeping that breath intentional, consider how touch affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and compassion in human relations. How touch embodies acceptance of one another and is a first step towards the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice. Consider, through your fingertips, you can feel the pulse of your neighbor. Through your singularity, you touch the life force. Finally, see if you can syncopate your breathing with the rhythm of your neighbor's heartbeat. Let that syncopation expand in your imagination to include the rhythms of everyone here, nodes on the interdependent web of all existence, facets of the sum that is greater than all these parts. Listen now to breath and blood and life. At one time, be grounded, be here, transcend. Amen. We leave this sacred time together. Our world needs us and the spirit we carry forth.
Let us become alive to the truth and the healing that we seek.
Amen.
Amen.